Okay. I must admit, that was a scary moment. I put this sermon here this morning when I came in, and it just wasn't there. Lyndon had nicked it. Can you believe it? Let's just pray before we look at God's word together. Let's just pray now. Lord, I thank you for your word, and I pray it would speak to our hearts now. I pray you help me as I speak, that give you my own weakness and failure, and ask that you would speak now through your word and help me to preach it clearly. I pray it would have an effect upon our lives, and it wouldn't go in one ear out of the other, and we'd forget when we leave. And in the time of reflection afterwards, that, you would be moving among us and stirring our hearts. We ask this in the name of Jesus. Amen. If you'd like to get a Bible and turn to page 1039, which is Luke chapter 9, it's in the New Testament, page 1039, and have that open in front of you, that would be helpful. Okay. If you've been coming here regularly, hopefully you'll know that for the last 3 weeks we've been looking at our mission statement, or the new mission statement that we introduced to the church in last summer. But we've been looking at these three things over the last 3 weeks. The Good Shepherd mission exists to make Jesus known locally, submit to his lordship collectively, and the one that we're going to look at today, which is walk daily with him individually. So last week was looking very much at what does God call us to as a church fellowship together? How do we live out submitting to Christ as a church fellowship and body? Today it's thinking more about our own individual walk with Christ. I wonder where in the world you have been. I wonder if in this relatively small sort of congregation we could cover the different continents that the world has. Who's been to Africa? Quite a few. Who's been to the United States of America? A lot. Most people. Wow. South America. Not many people been to South America. Australia. Yeah. Asia. Anyone been to China? Gary, you've been to China, okay. You've been a lot of places, that's good. Stay. Anyone been to China? Anyone been in the middle of a major desert? I'm impressed. Been on the outskirts one, they've been in the middle of a desert. Here's one I'm counting no one's been to. Anyone been to the South Pole? No one's been to the South Pole, the Antarctic. Pardon? Middle East. Oh, forget about the Middle East. I'm going to the South Pole now. Just because you wanted to put your hand up, Ross, I'm not, yeah. I know there's parts of the world I forgot there. Who's been to the South Pole, the Antarctic? I thought so. Very, very, very few people relatively have. Antarctica is 1.5 times the size of the USA. 5 million square miles, most of it is permanent ice. Anyone know the first person to reach the South Pole? First person, Ben? Yeah. Roald Amundsen, who was a Norwegian. You know what year? Anyone know what year? This is a bit of participation so you don't fall asleep on it. It was 1911. Oh, a little, someone is listening over there, that's good. Anyway, there was a big race to get to the South Pole, and Britain had its own contingent of people who tried to get there. And here's a picture of these who tried to get to the South Pole. Now, the guy in the middle is who? Captain Scott. The guy next to him is who? No, it's not Mike Houston. the guy next to him is Captain Wilson. as in the one who said, I'm just going out for a walk. And anyone know the guy on the left who actually wasn't on the trip where Scott and Wilson died, but he did try to get to the South Pole a number of times? Anyone know who that guy is? Shackleton, well done. Sir Ernest Shackleton. He was an amazing man who, I think he tried three times to get to the South Pole, and he had some incredible adventures on the way, but he never actually got there. But if you ever see the film of Shackleton that was brought out, it's really worth watching. Anyway, for one of his trips to the South Pole, he put this advert in the Times. Men wanted for hazardous journey, small wages, bitter cold, long days in complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful. He actually put that in the Times as an advert. And a lot of people responded, can you believe? He had a lot of people respond. Would you reply to that? I am getting onto the Bible in case you're wondering what this is happening here this morning. Jesus Christ did exactly the same when he laid out what being his disciple and following him individually actually entailed. And that's going to be our focus. I'll leave that there now, because after that we're going to show you, in a sense, the equivalent to what Shackleton said. Jesus said, this is what it will cost if you're going to be my disciple and follow me. The Bible passage we're looking at is Luke 9, verses 18 to 27. And what I want to do is look at it in two parts. The first part is verses 18 to 21. Now, the background briefly is this. Jesus had taken his disciples for a walk. They'd been with him for about 18 months, seen him do many miraculous things, heard his teaching, seen his actions. And so he asked them two vital questions. He brings the disciples together and he asks them this. Who do people say that I am? And then he looks at them and he says, well, who do you say that I am? And this was the answer. Verses 18 to 21 of Luke 9. Once when Jesus was praying in private and his disciples were with him, he asked them, who do the crowd say that I am? And they replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others that one of the prophets of long ago has come back to life. What about you? He asked, who do you say I am? And Peter answered, the Christ of God. Jesus strictly warned them not to tell this to anyone, and he said, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests and teachers of the law, and he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. The crowds did say that Jesus is a great prophet, but Peter declared that he was much more than that. He said that Jesus is the Christ of God. In Mark's gospel it says, you are the Christ, you are the Son of the living God. I think Peter must have felt pleased with himself for getting that right. But then comes the shock, because after they have, if you like, made this confession of who Jesus is, Jesus, for the first time to his disciples, reveals that he's going to have to suffer many things, be killed, and then be raised to life. Now, you read on in the gospel and they couldn't take it in. They couldn't take it in, but this is the first time that he told them this, 18 months into his time with them. Just want to pause here and ask a question before we look at the heart of what I want to look at, one verse that's coming up, and it's this. Is suffering a good thing? Do we think that walking with Jesus daily equates with suffering daily? I wonder how you'd answer that. Here's my response to that. It's this. Jesus was never interested in suffering for the sake of suffering. I think it's really important we consider this and we grasp this when we're thinking about what walking with him daily means. Let me explain. You go to John's Gospel, and in the 11th and 12th chapter in that Gospel, there's an interesting sequence of events. Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead. And not surprisingly, his popularity suddenly hit an all-time high. The result was that an emergency meeting of the Jewish Sanhedrin was called, and Caiaphas, who was the high priest then, made it clear that he thought Jesus must die. As he saw it, the death of Jesus would mean that the Jews would avoid trouble with the Romans. And it's better, he said, for one man to perish than for the whole nation to perish. You can read that in John chapter 11. And it says in John chapter 11, verse 53, so from that day on they plotted to take his life. Jesus was aware that's what they were doing. And it's interesting, he deliberately at that point sought obscurity in a place called Ephraim on the edge of the desert. Point is, he wasn't drawn to suffer for the sake of suffering. Neither then should we. The New Testament never suggests that suffering in itself is good. Let's be clear about this. Jesus faced the cross because it was the only way that sinners like you and I could be redeemed. He endured the cross, despising its shame, not because it was a virtuous thing to do, but because suffering and death were the price he had to pay in order to achieve the purpose for which he came. When he finally faced his passion, it was because his hour had come. I want to say this. You read the Gospels, Jesus was not a masochist. That's someone who enjoys pain. He was not an ascetic. I had to look up what an ascetic means, and it's one who aims to encompass holiness through the mortification of the flesh. Jesus wasn't an ascetic. Jesus faced suffering and death because he loved human beings and because there was no other way that he could save them. But he didn't pursue suffering as an end in itself, and nor should we think it's spiritual to do so. His conduct was guided by a dual principle: obedience to the Father's will and love for mankind. And both meant, when the time was right and his time has come, he was willing to go to the cross. But we know, if you read the Gospel accounts, when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, it wasn't without a huge struggle. So when we sing that beautiful hymn, I think it is one of my favourite hymns, My Song is Love Unknown. It's a brilliant hymn, except there's one line in it which is totally inaccurate, which is, yet cheerful he to suffering goes. He wasn't cheerful about what he had to face when he went to the cross. I thought I just wanted to highlight that before we looked at what he declared next. So with this in mind, let's now read, following on from that, verses 23 to 27. This is Luke chapter 9. Then he said to them all, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Whoever wants to lose his life for me will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet lose or forfeit his very self? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his glory and in the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. I tell you the truth, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the kingdom of God. Now, there's a lot there, but my focus is just one verse now. And you just want to put that up there, Edward? It's that one there. When Jesus said in verse 23, if anyone would come after me, they must deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. Now, if you've made a decision to be a Christian, or if you're thinking about it, you must know this verse. You must know this verse. Jesus does promise joy. Jesus does promise peace. He does promise to guide us, strengthen us. He promises never, ever to forsake us. I've been a Christian now for over 30 years. And I don't doubt any of those promises that Jesus gives. But he also made it clear that following him is not an easy, soft option. Like Shackleton's advert for his polar trip, he leaves us in no doubt actually what it involves. We've just finished the political party conference season. And one thing, if you listen to the news or the radio and you're into that, you get for 3 weeks of politicians giving us promises. But when the question comes, well, what would these promises cost? What's the price for your program? I guarantee this, the answer is usually really vague. Politicians are great on promises, but they're always very unclear about what it will cost. Not so with Jesus. Here he calls the crowd and lays out clearly what it costs if you're going to be a disciple of his. This is not an optional extra for the super elite, you know, for those really hard-line Christian disciples. This is for each and every Christian. Jesus, in this passage, declares who he is, the Christ of God, then what he would do, suffer and be killed, and then, following that, he makes it clear what is required for anyone who makes that choice to follow him. So let's think. First, we're called to deny ourselves. I wonder what comes to mind when you hear about this call to deny yourself. I'll tell you what it isn't. It isn't about giving up chocolate or whatever at Lent. It's not about fasting now and then in order to pray more effectively. Now, I think both those things are good disciplines, but I don't think this is what Jesus is referring to here at all. What this is about is giving up self-will. If you like, giving up the narcissistic self-worship that I think is so characteristic of our culture, something we're encouraged to do. There is no connection between self-will, self-worship, and being a disciple of Jesus. Now, forgetting self and denying self is not one of our favourite pastimes, is it? Isn't it much easier to pamper self, to live for self, to put self in the middle of everything that we do? That is our natural state. That's why Jesus calls us to something pretty radical when he says, if you're going to follow me, you've got to deny self. And I think he said this because he knew how easy it is for our lives to be completely dominated by our own self-interest. And the truth is that selfishness will prevent any real Christian growth. The decision to respond to this call of Jesus is a battle, and I say this, it's one that is never actually completely won. Do we ever get to the point of being totally selfless? I don't. I know it's an ongoing process, which is why I have to apply this every day. Because if I don't, I slip towards being self-centered. Maybe we need to start with something small, or at least with something that may seem small to other people. What might that be? Well, being willing to share around what you have. Making the effort to see someone you know you can help and encourage, but deep inside you'd rather not see. Doing something sacrificial and then not seeking the credit for it. Or even one step further, letting someone else take the credit for it. That really is denying self. There's lots of ways we can deny ourselves daily. Just think of the spiritual version of giving someone your last Rolo. That's what it is. Now, this summer, I read this book that John and Dorothy gave me called Spiritual Revolution, The Story of OM. Have you heard of OM? Operation Mobilization. It's a Christian missionary movement that is really big now. Been going 50 years, and it's a book being written about its history. Now, I found it a really good book. There are countless stories and examples of people who took what Jesus said about denying themselves and taking up the cross very, very seriously. This is just something from the first chapter. It's, I think, aptly titled called Reckless Abandonment. And it focuses upon how a group of young Bible college students, led by someone called George Boer, left Bible college and set to take the love of Christ to the world. And they started with Mexico. Anyway, I have to say this, George Boer is one of my heroes. If you've ever heard him speak, you'll never forget if you hear George Boer. Anyone hear George Boer speak? Did you forget it? No. I've got lots of stories about George Boer. I won't go. Anyway, this is in the book. This is when he was a young guy. He says this, to be sold out to Jesus Christ was to take very seriously what it meant to be a disciple. It meant acting on what Jesus said. If his instructions were to give away your coat to someone in need, Matthew 5, then there was no alternative to giving away the coat. Dale Roten offered an example of how George Boer implemented this teaching. It says this, while preaching in a small church in Greater Mexico City, George Boer was overwhelmed by the generosity of a collection that was taken. It was not so much money, but he knew the people had given so sacrificially. The pastor accompanied George to his van to say goodbye. Then George looked at the pastor and said, have you ever owned a suit? No, said the pastor. George looked and said, I have got plenty of clothes. It was night and the pastor could not see what George was doing. George took his suit off, handed it to him, and drove off in the van. It was quite a sight to see a young, skinny George Verwer in his underwear around midnight knocking on the door of the Christian bookshop where the team was saying, "Give your suit away, deny yourself." Not only that, but what about giving away your wedding cake? Here's another one. After their marriage in January 1960, George and Drina Verwer spent a few months living in Mexico City before moving to Spain. The Moody Memorial reported on the 18th of March on events in this period that became legendary. George Verwer, a January graduate, and Drina Keech, former film department secretary, were married in January and immediately set off in an old international truck, which mechanics said would never get out of Chicago, to continue the mission in Mexico. Having no money and running low on petrol, they stopped at a filling station. George explained to the proprietor about their wedding and their mission and asked if they could exchange their wedding cake, in fact this was one of two wedding cakes, for petrol. The proprietor said, "I'm a Christian, I'll fill your tank up and you keep the cake." Same thing happened a second time. The report concluded, by the third time the proprietor wasn't a Christian, so he did take the wedding cake. And I have to say this, 50 years on, George and his wife are still working out what it means to walk daily with Jesus, carrying your cross, denying yourself. Okay, after the call to deny self, comes that to take up our cross daily. Now, for the original hearers, I think we've got to say this, this would have been absolutely shocking. The crowd would have been familiar with the dreadful sight of a condemned criminal walking to the place where they were going to die and carrying the beam across their backs. I think we lose the shock of this because I'm presuming no one's here has ever witnessed a crucifixion. And of course, the cross is now a very safe, holy symbol. But if you're a Christian, you must take on board and take seriously what Jesus meant when he told us that individually we're to take up our own cross. If you want to follow me, he's saying, be prepared for what you have to face. They put me on a cross, and they might do the same to you. They ridiculed me, they may well ridicule you. You would do well then to arm yourself daily with a willingness to take whatever may come to you because you follow me. I think we struggle to really grasp this because we live in a country and a culture of tolerance. We live in a country where there's political and religious freedom, where making a stand for Christ at the moment publicly doesn't carry the threat of imprisonment or of death. Not so in other parts of the world. In 2007, last year, it's estimated that around 175,000 believers were killed because they were Christian. In countries such as China, India, the Middle East, Sudan, open faithfulness to Christ can actually cost the ultimate price. At the prayer meeting here on Wednesday night, Louise, who was in Egypt for many years, shared how one of her and Andy's close friends back in Egypt, who they had to leave when they were kicked out, recently was beaten nearly to the point of death because of his Christian conversion and because of his witness. They're now trying to find a way of getting him out of the country for his own safety. But I suspect, if you're like me, the reality is that the plight of our brothers and sisters, because that's who they are, in other countries, experiences, it seems very remote. Yet if you look at history, history shows that the crucifixion of Jesus set in motion a chain of reaction of harassments, imprisonments, and martyrdoms. In most parts of the world, for most of the past 2,000 years, followers of Christ have risked imprisonment and death. We would be foolish to assume our present freedom and protection will just continue indefinitely. Which is why I do think it's important, I don't think it's too dramatic, if you like, to ask ourselves this. Would I really be willing to risk imprisonment or even death for the sake of Christ? Now, I suppose your answer could be this. Well, No one knows how you would react until you're faced with it in reality. And I think that's true. But to that I'd say this. If you're faithful in little things while the freedom that we have lasts, the chances are you will be faithful when the big tests really come. If you are faithful to him, it may well make you unpopular and unprosperous. It may have the opposite effect. But the question is this, do you in fact put Christ first, whether it costs you or not? Do you have the attitude of heart that says, if following Jesus leads to suffering in whatever form, I'll still follow and I won't shirk back? Do I have this attitude and result in action daily? Now let's be honest, this is a really tough calling, isn't it, from Christ? He no way soft pedals the cost of commitment and what it really means to follow him. He's not like the politician who gives the promise without the cost. We are actually left, aren't we, from this in no doubt what the cost is. And let's be honest, this is so hard. The pull of the world is so powerful and so attractive. I think there's an ambition within us all to get as much as the world as we can. Do you ever dream of winning the lottery, even if you don't play it? I've never played the lottery, but I confess to you standing here, I sometimes find myself dreaming of coming into a huge amount of money because I think in my head it's the solution to everything, but it isn't. So because of the pull of the world is so great, Christ has to warn us again plainly about investing everything into the present. Let's read verses 24 and 25 again, because they've got to go alongside this one. 24 says this, "For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for me will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet lose or forfeit his very self?" See what Jesus does here? He moves from outlining the cost of following him, deny self, take up your cross, to actually the cost of not following him. He says, if we dedicate our lives to what the world has to offer in the present, then we actually risk losing everything in eternity. And when I think about it in that way, for me, denying self, taking up a cross, and following the one who died, rose, and now holds the key to death and life, is ultimately a completely logical choice. There is sanity here. Jesus is telling us how to save our lives in comparison to what we gain in the future. What have we really got to lose in the present? I think Jesus is not only warning us about losing the life in the world to come, which I have to say is awful enough, but ultimately losing this life as well, the life we've been given. Even if we gain the whole world, when we get to the end of our lives, we can't retrieve it. However rich, powerful, influential we may be, we can't trade it for a new chance and have life all over again. This precious life that we've got is relatively very, very short. It's unique. It's so full of possibilities that I think Jesus is saying here, you can't afford to waste it. For in the end, it's impossible to get it back and get another chance. So in light of that truth, the cost of following Jesus daily actually is not high when it's compared to the cost of not following him. It's a wonderful quote from someone called Jim Elliot, who went to be a missionary in South America and was martyred. He was killed as a young man. But he said this before he went, "He is no fool who gives that which he cannot keep to gain that which he can never lose." And Jesus said to them, "Deny yourself, carry your cross daily and follow me." And you read on in this gospel and we discover that he did indeed deny himself. He literally carried a cross and was nailed to it. Why? Because of his love and passion to save us. Because in the end it was the only way we could be forgiven and reconciled to God. So Jesus on the cross is the measure of God's love to us. And personally, I can't imagine where I'd be without the knowledge of this love. God's love gives me value. It gives me hope for the future. It gives me strength to press on in the here and now with the difficulties. It's the reason and the motive to be forgiving and to be giving in my relationship. It's the reason for choosing, if you like, to walk with him daily. But I have to be honest and stand here and say to you, it's not comfortable. It's not easy at times to follow. It's rarely painless. But ultimately, the question is it worth it? Sometimes people say that to me, this Christian life, is it worth it? No. The focus is on Jesus Christ and the love of God shown to us at the cross. And really the question is he worth it? Is he worth it? Is he worth laying aside those things that hinder me in my relationship with God and to trust him and to follow him every day? I can stand here and say it is. Even if it means embracing self-sacrifice and service. For there we discover the power of God, the grace of God, the promise of eternal life, and also freedom in the present. I want to finish with this quote from John Stott. He said this: "It is a wonderfully liberating experience when the desire to please God replaces the desire to please ourselves. And when love for others displaces love for self. True freedom is not freedom from God and others to live for myself. True freedom from self is to live for God and for others." And in the end, there can be no greater privilege than to decide to follow the one who didn't come to be served, but to serve. And he gave his life as a ransom for many, including you and I this morning.